Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Coco.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And Al Warren.
FM Los Angeles, 102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery, and of course, I'm Al Warren. Mr. Michael Butterfield is here.
Hi, Al.
Hey, so how's the old Zodiac thing going?
Unfortunately, no new news. I hate to say that, but yeah, it's,
well, I didn't really
53 years and going, yeah,
it's time for a revival, right? Another whole book series to come out.
Oh, don't worry. There's probably somebody out there writing a book about Kermit the Frog being the Zodiac. So that'll be on shelves soon, I'm sure.
He probably is. Or, you know, it's Sesame Street. Yeah. Good cover. Anyway, well, today we're going to jump right into it because we've got a great guest here. We've got quite the author. So, Mr. Joe Lansdale, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Joe, you've done a lot. And I don't know where to begin because
that's an understatement. Yeah.
Yeah. I just like, wow. So let's kind of go where it started for you. How did you decide to get into this kind of a business, or what led you into writing?
Ah, well, the insanity for one, you know, you, and I was growing up in East Texas, Gladewater, you know, area. I was born in Gladewater and lived in the East Texas area all my life. I didn't know any other writers. I didn't know anybody that wanted to write. I didn't know anything about editors or publishers. My father could not read or write. My mother had an 11th grade education, which back then was equal to a senior education. And she was a big reader. So she was a big influence in that area. But when I was about four, I wanted to write comics. I mean, I was reading when I was four because I started so early, and my mother, you know, helped me learn to read, and I would memorize the comics they would read to me, and then gradually I just, you know, kept picking it up. So by the time I was four, I was trying to write and draw comics, and I was a terrible comic artist, but I was pretty good at the stories. And over the years, I just kept, you know, cranking at it until I was 21 and sold an article with my mother under her name, and then I began to sell other articles, and then eventually I moved towards my real love, which was fiction, telling stories. And so I guess you could say since I was four, I've been working at it, been doing it all my life. And I've been published since I was 21 and full time since I was 29. That's a nutshell.
Did you expect this kind of these kind of results? How's that?
I expected to be able to do it. I expected to be able to make a living at it. But I think that I have had far more phenomenal success than I ever expected. And in more than just one aspect of writing, you know, so I can't say I expected that. I don't know exactly what I expected, but my wife and I we're happy every day with the success that we've had, you know, and we both worked all kinds of jobs. And, you know, my last job was as a janitor. And before that, I worked in the rose fields. I was a bouncer. I worked on a Lunar Chair Factory before I met my wife. You know, tons of things like that along. So there was nothing to indicate that I was going to have the kind of success I've had, you know, and doing it my way has probably kept me from having the same kind of financial success or the broader success that some have had. But it was exactly what I wanted. And I'm one of the few people I know that can honestly say I got what I wanted out of life.
You know, I read a quote where you said something like, when you first started out, you thought you were going to write serious stories. Mm. And then at a certain point, you realized that genre fiction was for you. What kind of serious stories did you originally think about writing?
I always loved genre fiction. It was never that I didn't want to write genre fiction. But I think, too, I always thought that I wanted to write a novel that was serious about my time and generation and all that sort of stuff. And then one day when I'd already, you know, sold some things, I was writing a novel called Savage Season. And I realized, you know what, this is my 60s novel. This is it. And even though it took place in the 80s, it was looking back at a time. And by doing it as a genre novel, I realized that I could suddenly do anything I wanted. I could have the pulp influences, the paperback influences, but I could also have the literary influences. And I realized that trying to be a literary writer wouldn't satisfy me. I mean, making that effort so I would be recognized as a literary writer. I wanted to tell stories above all. And then secondly, I wanted to have something to say, but not with everything. I didn't want to be tied to having to be pulp or literature or what have you. But I also felt that in some novels I was able to do a lot more because they were genre and people were more willing to read them because the vehicle was more interesting and more exciting and had the better line, so to speak. And so by doing it that way, I was able to do both. And I've also written stories that, you know, cross genres and mixed literature and pulp and all that. And it's whether, you know, you're a literary writer or a genre writer, ultimately you, other people will tell you that. You may be working in those fields and have certain intent, but time and readers, they reveal who you are and what you're doing.
Well, you certainly crossed a lot of genre lines with horror and Western and science fiction.
I have, no doubt about it. I've written for literary magazines. I've written for some of the, what was almost like the last of the pulps, as a digest size magazine, but Mike Shane Mystery Magazine. I wrote for sort of upper scale things like Twilight Zone Magazine when it first came out. I wrote for anthologies, primarily short stories early in my career. And then I moved to novels, and I wrote novels like Jane Goes North and Fender Lizards, which are not, strictly speaking, genre novels. And All the Earth Thrown to the Sky, they're published as, well, two of them were published as young adult novels, I guess. But I just felt like that I just didn't want to be tied to that. I did some children's books. I did one with my son and wife, and I did one on my own. I would like to do others, but, you know, if time's a restriction as I grow older, I have to really say, well, what is it that I'm going to do today? And I realized that I've always pretty much just done what I wanted to do, with some exceptions. You know, I'm a full-time freelance writer, and I make a living at this. You know, you know, if you want to have your electricity on and your bills paid, you tend to give regular exercise. And but for the most part, I've been able to look at things and say, look, what can I find in this that's exciting and interesting? And generally, I've always been able to find that. And mostly, I've been able just to proceed with my own interest, just, you know, follow that path.
It certainly worked.
It worked for me. I can't tell you exactly why. You know, I don't know. I like to think I have a voice that has some impact and is memorable. But some of it, you know, it's kind of the turn of the roulette wheel to some extent. You know, you got to be known in the right places to be known at all, meaning that the right people have to pick you up at the right time. Maybe you get the right word of mouth, because word of mouth built my career more than anything. Reviews were good, but word of mouth has been the thing that's carried me longer. And it got me into film. It got me into comics. It, you know, got me into all kinds of nonfiction and even poetry and stage plays. I mean, all of that comes out of my love for these things, but it also comes out of, you know, having a break here and there that led to a lot of other breaks. And success breeds success, and that's the truth.
Well, I was mentioning to Al before we went on the air that I read a quote from another writer which referred to you as the most well-known unknown writer.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. It's probably a little less accurate now. I've become better known
since
that quote, but I do think that's fairly accurate. My daughter actually said that in a documentary that Hanzi Oppenheimer did on me called All Hail the Popcorn King. And, and I think that, and she may have been quoting someone, but I remember her saying that. And I've heard two or three people say that over the years. And I think that there's a certain accuracy about that. And like I said, maybe less so in the last 10 years, but, I think that was it. I mean, people have been reading and seeing my stuff for years and not really realizing or putting it together that I was the guy doing all of that, or that they might know I wrote one sort of thing, but not know I wrote the other sort of thing. And I think that there was a culmination of that as, you know, Bubba Hotep, a film based on my work, helped. But I think Cold in July helped, which is another film. But I really believe the TV series gave a lot of recognition to the Happ and Leonard stories. And then that led to a greater recognition of my work in general. And maybe Love, Death, and Robots recently, I think that's even, you know, bumped it a little. So, you know, there's all of these things, and one is piled on top of the other. And I think I've been fortunate, instead of having like a big moment with us, you know, a lightning strike and everything, you know, goes my way, I've sort of built my career brick by brick, and I'm proud of it.
When you have that kind of success where you're doing well, do you have a problem trying to keep it fresh, or how do you keep kind of going?
Well, I think the main thing I do is I try to just keep myself interested. You know, the longer you're around, the more you realize that you are going to repeat certain themes and certain ideas, because those are things that intrigue you. The thing is that if I feel it's too familiar, I try not to do it, or I try not to move away from it. But on the other hand, a certain amount of familiarity is acceptable. Like in a series like Happ and Leonard, if you get too far afield of them, then they aren't Happ and Leonard. But yet you've got the problem of having to bring these characters back, which are now familiar to a certain audience, and try to keep them fresh. So I just, the only way I know how to do that is I just try to be excited about the work and find humor in things and find, all those things that I grew up with that have stayed with me. They're the real source of almost all of my work. You know, after a certain point, I think, you know, you learn new things, you have new experiences, but I believe those earlier experiences, and even if they don't always shape exactly what you're talking about, they shape the way you talk about it. So I find that if I can try to get in touch with my subconscious, that I'm happy. And I know full scale that sometimes when I'm writing something, I'm building a chair, where at other times I might be trying to build a cathedral. Now, whether I did that or not, either case is up to the reader to decide, but I'm going to try to build the damnedest best chair I can, as well as the best cathedral I know how to build, meaning that not everything, I don't ever compete with myself. I don't ever think, oh, this has got to be better than the last. I just say, it's time for the new thing. Do your best.
So Born for Trouble is the newest book in the Happ and Leonard series. Mm-hmm. Just those two characters, how do you create characters like that, and how do you make them so real? Because you're obviously not these characters.
Well, but to some extent I am, you know, and I think, yeah. First of all, I grew up in East Texas like Happ and Leonard. I worked in the Rose Fields like Happ and Leonard. I had most of the jobs they had. I grew up in a tough environment, although not my own personal, you know, my parents were great, you know, but there was a tough world in East Texas in the 1950s and 60s. And things were moving a lot slower there than they did in some other locations. In other words, it was probably the 1930s and 40s for 30 years. You know, you had new cars and new things, but, you know, things reached East Texas much more slowly. And when the internet came along, things like that boosted how fast people knew this or knew that. But I actually, you know, would not, obviously I'm not Happ and Leonard. I'm not, you know, having all these incredible adventures, and I'm not doing these things that I think are actually criminal that they do. But I do believe that most of what they are is who I am, you know, at least in the base of that, in the center of that. And I think that's what makes it easier for me to write about them. And Leonard is based on people I knew and me. And a Happ is based on me and some people I knew, you know, and that's what a writer does. You're kind of a magpie. You pick a little something here, pick a little something there, and you bring it all back to your nest. And so that's the best I can answer that. I, you know, some things I think that as a writer, you can express why or this or that, but some things are beyond the understanding because you don't know what's in your head and all those things and how they've, you know, blended in the way that they have. I mean, I'm not saying supernatural or anything. I'm just talking about, you know, from the standpoint of what we think and how our experiences shape us. I don't know that we always know the exact truth. You know, I can think of a few epiphanies in my life here and there, but for the most part, I think that, you know, we trudge along and hopefully learn from our past or from our experiences, which overall in humanity doesn't really seem to be the case. We don't necessarily learn from those bad experiences and try to do things better. We keep repeating the same things over and over.
Oh yeah.
So, you know, I don't know that that's even a definitive answer, but I do think that it has a lot to do with my environment. It has a lot to do with, to some extent, with genetics, though. I think environment can certainly trump genetics to a great extent in many cases. I think it has to do with my own, you know, life experiences, which again is just an extension of the idea of environment. And it also has to do with other people I've observed and listened to. And it has to do with the fact that I'm a voracious reader and always have been. So I've accumulated those experiences, but I don't just have the stink of the library on my work because I've lived life. You know, I haven't sailed around the world on a log or climbed, you know, Everest in skis or anything, but I've lived a real life, And I think that that makes it different than sitting down and just writing about characters you made up entirely. I borrowed from many, many things to stitch them together.
We interview a lot of writers for different things, and quite a few fiction writers will say they experience their characters like either like a movie or hear voices in their head, and I hear all these different things. What's your personal experience with your characters?
You know, I'm a big believer in writing from the subconscious and not the conscious mind. The conscious kind of cleans things up, but the subconscious knows things you don't know. And I don't plot. I never sit down and plot because that makes the characters unreal to me. But my subconscious must, you know, it must be putting these things together so that when I sit down, it goes, okay, here it is. And it just starts unraveling. And it is very cinematic for me. I think it's because I'm not only influenced by a tremendous amount of reading, I'm influenced by cinema. I'm a big fan of films, and I've written scripts and things like that. And I love comic books. I love their imagery. I love painting and painters, and all of those things have somehow blended together to create how I see these characters. And then I borrow from the way I hear people talk. Of course, I try to give the illusion of how people talk more than trying to give exactly how people talk, because it makes it more interesting when the characters have something that's intriguing to say, instead of the guy going, yeah, damn, I wish I'd have said that smart line that I didn't say, you know, and things like that. But to me, it goes back to the same thing. It's an accumulation of all that, and it is very cinematic.
Well, I was going to say, a friend of mine is a huge fan of your work. He seems like every other week he's all excited because he just ordered one of your books for his
That's
collection.
Right. That's wonderful.
And if you don't mind, he gave me a few questions to ask.
Sure. Sure, go
ahead. The first is, will we ever see a Jim Bob Luke novel? Now, Jim Bob Luke first appeared in your novel Cold in July,
correct,
and later appeared in some of the Hap and Leonard books.
Also correct.
Have you ever thought about giving him his own story?
I have. The problem I've had with Jim Bob is he's so confident and he's so egotistical about his abilities. It could make for a funny book, but it also makes it hard for you to write as objectively as you would like. I mean, I think I would, you know, if you did it, you do it in first person is my favorite way of writing, but I might have to step back and do it in third. But then again, I think that might not work either. It may be like eating too much chocolate. He may be a better, he better be an occasional character or a character actor than be the star. So I don't know if I ever will or not, but yes, I have thought.
Do you have any other favorite recurring characters who might be worthy of their own stories?
Vanilla Ride. I think there's a chance that I will write a story or a book about Vanilla Ride. And she appeared first in the novel called Vanilla Ride, which was a Hap and Leonard novel. And she appeared in Devil Red and Honky Tonk Samurai. And I don't think anything else other than those three. But she certainly had an impact, you know, and it's funny because when I wrote those three novels, especially the first two, I almost felt like that I had kind of lost that more down to earth feel for the Hap and Leonard novels. And it was kind of a broader approach. But I also, when I reread them years later, I thought, no, it's still Hap and Leonard, but it is also a broader approach. And it was fun. It kept the characters from getting stale. And then when I went back to them in Rusty Puppy, Jack Rabbit Smile, it was much more like the original Hap and Leonard books. But I think I was always consistent with who they were and how they acted. And so I'm really pleased with the 12 novels I've written, the four collections of stories and novellas. I've had great fun with them, but I do believe that Vanilla Ride has the potential to being a really good breakout character. And so I have thought about it.
Forgive me if I'm wrong about this, but didn't Don Johnson play Jim Bob Luke?
Yes, he did.
Cold in July.
Yeah, he was very good.
And then you had the Hap. That's what I was going to say. And then you had the Hap and Leonard series for Sundance, I believe.
Right.
Does seeing the characters portrayed by actors ever influence what you think? Do they ever bring something to the character that you didn't think of or that you incorporate into your writing?
They sometimes bring something to the character I didn't think of, and they may bring it brilliantly, but I'm not much influenced by that because the characters are already mine and I already visualize who they are. And it would be hard for me to start saying, well, they're this or that. But I see the Happy Leonard series as an alternate universe version of my series. And I think it's just great. Purefoy really did a great job of producing the way I would feel Hap thinks, and he got that underlying actual kindness that Hap has, and his sort of feeling that I'm making a lot of mistakes. And then I thought that Michael K. Williams really brought Leonard to life, although he was much smaller than I didn't consider Leonard a giant, but I thought he'd be a bigger, more muscular kind of guy, and so I didn't visually at first think of him, but once he became that character on screen, he was that character. But in my head, they're still my characters that I create.
Well, I think that there's a, I don't know if this is the correct word, but there's a certain zaniness to your writing. And how important is when you have those adapted by people? Like, I thought Don Coscarelli was a great choice to adapt your work.
Right. Well, actually, Don wasn't a choice. He sort of took it. He was a guy that wanted to do it, and he optioned it. So nobody chose him because he was the producer, and or at least a producer. He directed it. He wrote the script. He did for everything but act in it. And if he'd had time, he might have played all the parts. He's just that kind of guy. But he was perfect. He did a wonderful job. He did Incident on and Off of Mountain Road for Showtime as well, based on my story.
Yeah.
And he did a good job of that, too. And Bruce Campbell and Ossie Davis, you couldn't ask for a better pair, a better cast. And, that's how I became friends with Don and Ossie. I knew Don before that. We'd already become friends. He came and stayed at the house for a while trying to convince me to let him have the rights to certain things. And some of them were already acquired. But he later acquired Bubba and on and off of Mountain Road and optioned those. But, it made a kind of bond, I think, between us, because when you're working low budget, I think there's a different feel to it. And Don would not like for us to call it a B movie. And I get what he means by that. But I think Bruce agrees with me. It's a B movie in the best sense of the word. It doesn't have a lot of money. Yeah. It's not trying to, startle you and dazzle you with special effects. It's just damn good acting. And it has a thematic depth that goes beyond the sort of metaphorical setup.
Now, I was going to ask you, for those of us who are looking to read a collection of your short stories, which of yours would you recommend? Do you have a favorite?
Wow, that's a tough one. A lot of them are coming back into print now. So if you're going to read on a Kindle, you can go online from Subterranean Press, and they have republished in ebooks the books that were published by SST that are 4 volumes. And they don't cover all my work, and they're not each story the best, but they're some of the best amongst them. And there's some that are, I think, are outstanding or good or quirky enough to include. And there's 4 volumes. There's Cosmic Interruptions, which deals kind of with the science fictional stuff. These are arbitrary, especially in my case as far as titles and things, but Cosmic Interruptions, and then Blood in the Gears, which leans more towards crime, and Wet Juju, which leans more towards horrific or strange, and then Gothic Wounds, which deals with kind of gothic stories, but it also cheats and deals with westerns and historical stuff and some very curious odds and ends. So if you could go online for those 4 books, you've got, and they're huge books, so you've got a lot of reading there. And it would give you kind of an overall view of my career. And if you were looking for a best of volume, which I think it is a little outdated, but it's still good and it's available from Tachyon Books, is The Best of Joe R. Lansdale. So those would be the ones I would recommend off the top of my head. Many of them are going to be rearranged and reprinted in the near future. Because I had people say, well, I have that book. Why do you keep, redoing them? I say, because you have that book and that book's out of print and there are new readers. I'm fortunate that I get new readers all the time. And I want them to have those stories that may be no longer available.
Now, is it true that your personal favorite of your novels is Paradise Sky?
It is true, yes.
What draws you to the Western genre?
Well, I like all of the genres, and sometimes when I'm working on one genre, I'm anxious to get to another. You know, maybe that's because you have hard days or something, but I love all of it. But, you know, when I was a kid, my dad was a big fan of Westerns. And like I said, he couldn't read or write. Towards the end of his life, he got to where he could kind of dope out the newspaper and comic books. And he tried to read books. He tried hard. He would spend months reading one paperback, but it was always a Western paperback. And I'm sure he didn't get the totality of it, you know. But but to wait till you're 50-something to start learning to read is, you know, quite a thing. And then he never really did learn to read, and he never learned to write anything but his name. But he liked Western movies and Western TV series. And so I grew up in the era when those were hot. And so he and I would watch those. And I think that my early reads of Westerns didn't impress me much because I didn't much care for them. I didn't think the ones I read were very good. And then later on in life, and when I was in my 20s in the 1970s, I began to read more Westerns and thought, wow, I just read the wrong ones. And so as I began to read more Westerns, I found that there was something deep inside of me that was moved by them. And I think part of that was the fact that my father was born in 1909. He was 42 when I was born. My mother was born in 1914. So when my dad was born, you know, Buffalo Bill was still alive. Annie Oakley was still alive. White Earp was still alive. Bat Masterson were still alive. And some of them died when he was a teenager, you know. And it's just amazing to think about. And his past coming from poverty, coming from absolutely no education, going to work at 8 years old. He was not that far from the Old West. And he told stories that had been passed down to him, as well as stories of his own, because the West didn't just say it's 1900, I quit. You know, the elements of that continued on into the early 1900s. And in fact, World War I is sometimes called the Cowboy War because of the use of horses. And of course, Pancho Villa was pursued across the Texas state line into Mexico by, you know, horse-drawn cavalry. Horse-drawn artillery and cavalry and things of that nature, because, you know, those things were still going on. So I think that may have impacted on me, as did the Great Depression, which my parents went through as, you know, young adults or certainly young men and women. And they had a lot of stories about that because, you know, my dad worked all kinds of horrid jobs to survive, and as well as my mother. And so they came out of that, I think, scarred by it to some degree, but also feeling like champions because they had survived it. And though we never had a lot of money, I think they thought we were living a damn good life. I know I did. I didn't think anything about it because so many people around me were the same. But compared to what they had been through, they thought that. And I think that the 30s, as well as the Old West stories and things, impacted me so that the Western and sort of things in the 30s and stuff seemed to have had a great, you know, influence on the sort of things I write.
Well, I was also going to ask you if you have any more projects lined up with your kids.
Yes. My daughter and I, of course, we had a book of short stories come out, but it's being done in a special edition from SST Press, a small run, but a special, really cool looking edition of Terra Is Our Business. Casey and I also have a collection of short stories that we've written together, unrelated to those characters, called Dark Kin, which comes out from Thunderstorm Books. She and I have a comic book series coming out from Dead Sky. We turned in the first issue, and we've written some independent short stories since then. My son and I have worked together we had a novel that we did together, and he wrote a screenplay based on one of my stories that I hope to direct as a film, if all things continue in that direction. And we have other things planned together. So, yeah, I think there will be more, you know, because of how long I live.
Well, you've done a lot of work in comic books, especially if I remember correctly, for Jonah Hex and things like that.
Yeah.
How do you feel about the way that comic books have kind of taken over film and television these days?
Well, I think film took over comic books. So I think
that's probably right.
Comic books don't sell that well anymore. And the characters from the comics, what happened is that one of the things when we were kids, if we read superhero comics like Batman or Iron Man or whatever, because I had all of those things. I read all the original Marvel. I used to have them all. The old story about, you know, your mom throws away your comics. But I think the difference is that in more recent years, that the stuff that you couldn't do on film, you'd see a film and it always like, Batman, that doesn't look right. And then all of a sudden now they have special effects that rival what an artist can do, what a comics can do, because it's just another form of art. And yet it moves and it's impressive and it's it fills a giant screen. And I think a lot of the things that made superhero comics unique are no longer unique to comics anymore. But I think the popularity of those kinds of stories, are obviously continuing just in a different way.
Now, this might come out of left field here, but I read this about you and I just had to ask. Yep. You were chosen to finish a Tarzan story after Edgar Rice Burroughs died. What is that like for someone being known for your own style? How do you bring that to writing a character from another writer?
Well, I'm a great fan of Edgar Rice Burroughs. I think a lot of his stuff is dated and such, but he was the first writer that kind of made me want to write, but he was the first writer that impacted me in such a way I knew I had to write. And he was such a great storyteller. So I was well versed in everything that he had written. You know, I'd read up the Tarzan, the John Carter of Mars, the Pellucidar, all of the other individual books that he had written that were available, you know, to us in paperback. And once I found one, I started searching for all of them. And so I was on the phone with, I think it was Jerry Prosser, who at that time worked at Dark Horse. And it may have been someone else, you know, I don't remember exactly. And we were talking about some other project that I was doing there or was being done for my stuff. And whoever this editor was mentioned that they had the rights to Tarzan, to the Edgar Rice Burroughs Tarzan. And I said, man, that's fantastic. And he said, yeah, and we have this unfinished Tarzan novel that we're going to hire somebody to finish. And I said, oh, man, you need to get Philip Jose Farmer. You know, he's one of my favorite writers. I really like him. And he would just do you a tremendous job. And they said, well, we were thinking of you. And I said, well, the hell with Philip Jose Farmer. Yeah, I'll do it. So I had a real short deadline. And I didn't try to, like, copy his style verbatim because I had a kind of my own style. But I tried to find a place where I didn't jettison his style, and I had 80 pages of his work, which I moved around. And, you know, some of it had dated attitudes about race and women and things that were not just a little off, but were extremely off. And I sort of felt like I knew why this one had never been published and it was in a safe. It wasn't his best work. And I think he recognized that and put it away. But I think it turned out to be a good novel when I sort of moved some things around and made some of the things a little bit more, you know, I didn't do it politically correct because I don't like the extreme political correctness. But, you know, this was so much of a time when black people were looked upon as, you know, lesser human beings. And actually Burroughs could be very inconsistent about that. Sometimes he would have a different viewpoint there, but it wasn't just the character's viewpoint. It came across as the novel writer's viewpoint. And so some of that stuff I updated, but for the most part, I kept it pretty much what he was doing and just finished it out. And it was a great, great pleasure to have done. And then later on, I was hired to do a Tarzan novella and a John Carter short story. And I greatly enjoyed those. And it's possible that I may, in fact, do more work in that arena, you know, because those were the things that first impressed me as a child. And so it's sort of a respectful thing, but it's also nice to slip into that particular kind of story, which I don't think is particularly that popular anymore because it's been mutated, borrowed, and worked on so many times. But that doesn't keep me from being interested in it.
Now, those were culminated in, I think it was a 4-volume set called Tarzan, The Lost Adventure. Is that correct?
They were individual. There were 4 individual kind of pulp style comics, and then they were put into a novel. And that came out in hardback and then paperback. And I think they're redoing, I think, all of the Tarzan books in special editions and things. And of course, that one will eventually get there. I hope while I'm still around, you know, because there are a lot of Tarzan books. You go like 20 something years, 30 years. Yeah, you're still doing Tarzan.
I'm wondering. So what is the a day in the life of Joe Lansdale? How do you plan your writing time, and can you just actually plan it, sit down, outline, and do it?
Or do you have to be in particular? I don't outline it.
You don't outline.
No. What I do is that I work every morning. You know, I very rarely take off because since I'm not going to work more than 3 hours a day, what's to take off from? You know, every now and again, I will take a day off or feel like I need to get away from a project. But there's a difference in goofing off and taking off. And so I try never to goof off. I say, well, I get up in the morning and I go in, I have my coffee, my piece of toast. I go up to the computer. I turn it on. I hit the highlights on the email, the fan page, and then I jump right into it. And because I don't want to wake up too much because I want to be somewhat in that semi-dream state. And I start writing, and I go 3 to 5 pages is my limit of, my bottom. And if I get more than that, and sometimes I do, sometimes I'll get 10 or 15 pages, but it all sort of comes together within about 3 hours. And I couldn't tell you why that is. And sometimes I'll get 3 pages and think, I don't want to do any more today on this. And I'll switch over to a short story and work on it or some other project. But because I show up almost every day, including holidays, because I'm not really affecting holidays since I work early and since I'm done before anybody's deciding to do Thanksgiving or Christmas or whatever it is, it makes me seem far more prolific than I am. I'm a steady writer and I write reasonably fast. But the real key to my being prolific really has to do with just showing up. I don't believe in the muse. I don't wait for the muse to show up because I am the muse. I'm writing this stuff, you know, and when I get up in the morning, 9 times out of 10, by the time my feet hit the floor, I'm already ready. You know, I haven't thought about it in any big conscious way. And I just let the subconscious tell me the story. So I'll be surprised if I outline something, I lose interest in it. I don't really want to do it. And I'm not saying that's a bad way of doing it for other people. There's no set way of doing it. It's what works for you, but outlining definitely doesn't work for me.
Well, I saw some great advice you had given writers when you said, just get your butt in a chair and write.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other thing too, is that when you're writing, you got to write like everybody you know is dead. You can't be writing.
That was a great
friends
one.
Or people and things like that. Now, when you get done, you can hope like hell other people like it. But I think when you're writing it, if you're sitting there and you're constantly conscious of other people's viewpoints or how they'll receive this, agents, editors, friends, you know, family, whatever, I think you're screwed because it's already getting away from you. It's starting to be somebody else's story, whether you know it or not. But if you write your story when you get done and you had a good time doing it, usually you'll find that there are people who respond to the same things that you respond to. And it causes you, for me anyway, often causes me to make choices that are totally outside the box. And sometimes I feel like I want to do something that's somewhat traditional in feel. And I try to do that as well as I can, but I also try to make it have its own approach to that tradition and to sort of create another layer on top of it or under it. So to me, it's a joy to be a writer. I'm not one of those that loves having written. I like writing and then having written as well.
So it does mood or things going on around you affect how the outcome is? You know, like look at the last couple of years, all the craziness and the pandemic and all the, you know, political fighting and stuff. Does kind of mood or the tension around you kind of seep into the writing or maybe affect it?
Yeah, I think it does. I think that even subconsciously it does. You know, you I don't think it affects the quality of my work, but it sometimes affects the content. And so in that way, things going on around me or things that I'm interested in or things that I'm seeing or hearing may find their way directly into the work, but more often they find their way metaphorically into the work because I'm not always conscious that I'm doing it.
Well, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned that you get up and check your fan mail and things like that. You obviously had said that your career has been built a lot on word of mouth.
Right.
How important is it nowadays with Facebook and social media and everything to connect with your fans? Because I've heard that you're very appreciative. And
I am very appreciative of my readers. You know, I tend to think of them more as readers than fans, but I'm very appreciative of it. But at the same time, I wish I didn't have Facebook or Twitter or any of that stuff, because I think that there's so much other stuff that it goes with it, you know, but I don't spend a lot of time on it. I hit it through the day on Twitter, for example. I'll hit through the day, but by the time of the end of the day, I probably spent 20 minutes. And I respond quickly. I'm not, you know, I don't have a long time between putting something together, because I know that this is my time just to be loose, not to try to be, produce literature on Twitter, you know. And so for me, I enjoy the contact with readers. And but, you know, people make the mistake of thinking that Twitter is the universe, and it's not. You know, I'm not like a super politically correct guy, but I politically I lean left, and I always have, but I'm not a far left or far right, because I think they're the same people, they're the same jackasses. So if I get that on my Twitter or whatever, that stuff, I just go gone, you know, or I sometimes I'll respond if they're reasonable and what they're trying to say. But if it's just, you know, some hysterical, approach to their viewpoint, then I just get rid of them. But on Twitter, it's kind of gotten down to where it's book people and people in like, they like books and films and things of that. And my fan page is not a Facebook page. I'm listed as having a Facebook page, and they have me as it's my Facebook page. I never go on it. I go to the fan page, and that Facebook page, there's no telling what's on it. All these ads, all these different stuff, but you have to have that page to have the fan page. And so, you know, the fan page is a lot easier to handle. There's not as much stuff. You know, you got 30,000 people, but not 30,000 people are writing you every day, you know?
Yeah.
And I also just have a built in thing that says, okay, I've spent that much time, I'm not spending any more today. And, I try to respond to everybody, but I can't, you know, it's just too much. But, I'll try to answer a question that maybe several people have asked. And maybe that way I cover a more ground. But if you didn't have to do a lot of the work yourself today to promote yourself, to make sure people even know those books are out there, I probably wouldn't do either one of them. Although certainly there are people, friendships that I've made that I would miss. But outside of friendships I've made online, I'm not one of those people that always, you know, takes to heart that I've got this person on my Twitter page. And, you know, I don't want to end up like thinking I've got this great friend and it's just somebody on Twitter. And I don't want them to do that either. You know, some people you can meet that way and have a real friendship that way. And there's nothing wrong with that. But on the whole, I want to know people face to face. You know, when Bill Paxson optioned, the company, whoever he was working with at that time, I forget who we had at that time, but optioned the Bottoms. I already liked his work, but when I met him at a film festival, we hit it off and became good friends and whatever, but it made a difference not knowing just the persona that they present that you see, which can be transferred to like Twitter or a fan page or whatever, but you meet somebody in person, you begin to realize who they are. And you just, you know, and you know, Bill wasn't a movie star type guy. He was just this great human being. And that's what interested me. And I wanted to make sure. And I'd always loved his work. And, you know, I saw the film he directed, Frailty, which was just awesome. But then it really, for me, it had more to do with personal contact. I mean, sometimes my agent will make deals with people I don't know. And, you know, that happens. You can't do this business and expect to meet everybody all the time. But, you know, I really loved meeting him. And you know, there are good people in this business, even though there are a lot of lousy people in the film part of it. There are good people like Bill was wonderful, and Bruce Campbell and Don, and you know, and many others, Jim Mickle and Nick DiMicci. I mean, all of these people have become friends, but not because we were friends on Twitter, but because we actually had the opportunity to meet.
Yeah. So how do people get a hold of you or find you? Do you have a website?
I have a website. I have the fan page, and I have the Twitter page, and I apparently have an Instagram page, but I don't use it at all. My daughter set it up, and she uses it to help promote things of mine. She's a wonderful promoter of my work and helps me a lot of things, as my wife has done, you know, nearly our entire life. She actually is the secret behind all of our successes, because she's managed our careers. She's not an agent, but she always kept everything together. She's kind of retired from that now, because as time has gone on, we've had accountants and agents and all of this other stuff that ends up you have to have just to keep going, unless you want to spend, you know, have my poor wife spend, you know, 20 hours a day working on it.
They can go to joelansdale.com though, right?
They really can. But I, you know, my favorite place for people to contact me is probably my fan page or Twitter.
Oh, there you go. Now we're going to have that up on the website as well, so people can find you with one click that are
I'm easy to find. But,
He's easy to find. Just type in his name. You'll find him. Yeah. Well, it's been a real pleasure having you on the show.
Thank you.
Oh yeah.
You know, good luck with everything. Keep going. And
you too.
And I have to, your one book coming out, I have to say, the one, it's called the Donut Legion.
Right.
What's that going to be about?
Well, it's a conspiracy novel, really, in a way. I think it's about fanatics, people that have taken some sort of stupid idea to heart, but it's no more stupid than the real ideas people have taken to heart. And I did a lot of research on that. And at first I thought, oh, this is just crazy. And then I started reading all these books and things where people had these, you know, very conspiratorial beliefs and, you know, crazy beliefs about this and that. And I just felt like that this was all, it gotten to where it was no longer a fringe group, but just, you know, the crazy of the week. And I just thought that this particular book would be good to express that. I didn't know it when I was writing it, but I was reading all these other things. And when I started writing this book, which I thought was just a crime novel, a mystery novel, and then what happens always happens, like what we referred to earlier, is that things that interest me or things that are going on in my life seep into the work.
Looking well, forward to that.
Yeah, you certainly got a lot to draw from lately.
yeah, that's true.
Yeah, it's crazy. Well, again, thank you very much. Our guest today has been Joe Lansdale. Thanks.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.